I would argue that Bevo is a perfect case example of what that is. We are on Mud Island building this immersive experience. And sure, it's going to have to fit inside a wider development. Are there going to need to be developers that figure out the other pieces to this? Absolutely. But I would argue that we are the kind of beachhead on the island, if you will, that's redeveloping an asset. And it is a very similar public cheering that Mud Island is getting that the Coliseum got. The people want to see the Coliseum come back. People want to see Mud Island come back.
Hey there, this is Dennis Black, and you're listening to the Black and Wyatt Records podcast. This week, filmmaker and sculptor Mike McCarthy talks with Marvin Stockwell, the co-founder of the Coliseum Coalition, as well as co-founder of Bevo, and so much more. And now, here's Mike McCarthy in conversation with Marvin Stockwell.
Talk a little Baron von Opper being in the River of Time.
Well, I do want to catch up with you right off the bat on what's new. We got Marvin Stockwell. We got Marvin mm-hmm. Stockwell here tonight, mm-hmm. and I got to say, it's a rainy, horrible night to come out. It's the time just went back. It's an hour later for old us old guys
we'll
than
fun.
It ought to be.
Yeah.
The election's going on right now.
Yeah. Are we rolling?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Great.
That's our style.
Yeah, gotcha. No, it is a dark and rainy night, and it is election night. But it's on the way over here. I was listening to NPR, and they're in that zone of coverage where they have to be on air, but they don't know anything yet. You know, they're like, well, you know, Vermont has gone for Kamala Harris, but it's like everything that's been declared now is just. It is the stuff that we already knew that was going to happen. So, like, they're essentially, we're in the sky is blue kind of territory, you know.
Alice Cooper didn't get elected in 74, I knew the whole thing was rigged. Because if you can't vote for someone who's going to stop, you know, well, the ward stopped technically, I guess. So there you go. He had no platform.
Yeah. This is all of a sudden, you know, getting my mind in Prince Mongo territory, you know. So
Prince Mongo. What's your favorite? Yeah. What's your favorite things about Memphis?
Oh gosh,
top five.
I'm a true Memphis homer, so I absolutely drank the Kool-Aid on Memphis a long time ago. I'm a big, and you know this about me, Mike. I'm a glass overflowing optimist, right? So I believe in my city. The whole like, well, you know, in Memphis, the maverick city like us is what created rock and roll. And you know what? I'm like. That might be some marketing copy, but I also think it's the truth. So I'm proud to be of Memphis, from Memphis. I like the fact that I live in a city with firsts that, you know, the Piggly Wiggly, you know, started the retail grocery chain in the way we know it today. It was started here. FedEx is from here. My dad was a 25-year, you know, FedEx lifer. So I like living in a city that has the DNA of innovation. And myself as a creative person that likes to bring my creativity and ingenuity to the projects I work on, I like living in a city like that because I'm like, that resonates with me. I feel like I'm at home in a city like that. So I don't know whether that's a top five, but I like living in an innovative city. I think that Memphis has a special history. It's not all of it's good, right? Dr. King was assassinated here. But I think we have a rich narrative backcloth. We are a city that has a rich and fascinating and interesting story and history. And I just feel like if you follow that all the way back and then all the way forward, it is absolutely consistent that we're part of that. I recently had former Shelby County historian Jimmy Ogle out to Mud Island, and he toured through Baron von Opper being in the River of Time, which we can talk about here in a second. And, you know, Jimmy knew he gave me the backstory and every blade of grass on Mud Island and every paper clips left over from in the old museum that we're repurposing. But my point is, Jimmy can tell the story. He can tell the story backwards, but also Jimmy can kind of imagine it going forward. And I think that's what makes him such a special kind of like local treasure. But I mean, listening to him and then thinking about my own projects fitting into that, I just think to myself, I don't think I'd want to live in any other city.
Right. Well, and on that note, how could we I mean, this is jumping into big mm-hmm. topics here.
Jump away.
How could we be better?
Well, I think...
In five ways.
Yeah.
or even three ways.
Yeah. I think we need to be... We need to get beyond our mechanism that we've relied upon for things to move forward, i.e., only certain named people being associated with things are the things that can move them forward.
What do you mean by that?
I mean named people of note. You know, like, take a good example, Crosstown Concourse. You know, that only resonated with certain people as going to happen when they go, oh, Staley Cates is the money guy behind Crosstown. Well, that makes sense. Oh, okay, I guess this can happen. And to speak no ill of Mr. Cates, because like you're absolutely right, that project could not have happened without him. But I think there's a narrative in Memphis that's like, okay, well, who's the known named person with that project? Then and only then will I believe that can go forward. I think we need to allow new players at the table. And I think it needs to be less of a kind of closed system, which, hey, names that do amazing things, Billy Orgel, you know, like Billy Orgel's one of those guys. It's like, oh, it's a Billy. Well, okay. Well, gosh, why didn't you say so? It looks like that project's going all the way to the finish line. Again, it's beautiful. I'm glad that we have people like Billy Orgel who live in our city, who make great projects go forward. But you know, that's not the only way things can go forward. We need a more open and inclusive process that invites, you know, people not at the table to the table more fully.
And do you think that what you're talking about is a bottom-down versus top-up strategy? Like with the Coliseum, you and I go back to 2014, 2015.
Yep.
We put on the Roundhouse Revival.
Mm-hmm.
We were in the Coliseum Coalition together along mm-hmm. with a lot of other great people. That was very much a people movement, grassroots, bottom up type thing, which has yet to receive its top down commitment.
Right.
Whereas I think Crosstown Concourse, you can pinpoint a couple other things,
mm-hmm.
or maybe more top down than and the public has sort of met it halfway once mm-hmm. it's there. I mean,
I like that explanation.
Crosstown is uh-huh. filled with people now that probably wouldn't have thought about.
Mm-hmm.
living there or shopping there when all this was first introduced, mm-hmm. the news of it all was introduced. Do you think that, jumping to the Coliseum yeah. real quick, what is it lacking? What is the top-down lacking?
I think, no, you're absolutely right. And as so my podcast, Champions of the Lost Causes, is all about an analysis of why people champion causes, what sustains them, and what helps them succeed. And so
this mm-hmm. is your podcast.
Yeah, my podcast, okay. Champions of the Lost Causes.
Okay. Which is still going on.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, okay. And I've done podcast road trips with my kids the last two summers. We've gone all across America, and I've interviewed people who have championed all sorts of causes. And some are more bottom-up, more people's movements. You know, Save the East Phillips Depot in Minneapolis was a matter of, like, environmental racism. And this happens a lot. You know, Justin Pearson here locally stopped the pipeline from going through South Memphis. I think that a lot of, you know, polluters, they choose the path of least resistance. And in the past, it's been obvious that the recipe for those people looking to pollute are, what's the community we can step on and they won't push back, or the system will be rigged in such a way that we can roll over them with impunity. I think that's obviously starting to change with, and you know, the kind of environmental racism subset of the environmental movement is now a flourishing, you know, growing concern within the environmental movement. But my point is, back to causes, is they have all sorts of different types. Yes, some are kind of like city-led, some are developer-led, and I would argue, yes, no, Mike, you're right. Ours was a people, the Coliseum movement was a people's movement that, you know, we sprung up out of necessity. You know, I'll never forget the day, you know, fall 2014, right, about 10 years ago from right now, where you said, I said, Mike, how's it going, man? And you said, and you gave me this look like, oh man, dude, I'm not doing good. And I was like, what's going on, Mike? He's like, well, did you read the news? They're going to bulldoze the Coliseum. That's all. And of course I said, oh Mike, they'd never do that. You know? And next thing I know, I co-founded a movement and it was its co-spokesman with you. But my point is, why has it taken 10 years and the Coliseum's not still open? Well, one of the answers to that question is it's a hard project. But like, it's, sometimes I think that people champion causes precisely because they're hard, and it's like, if it should be, it's almost that it's that thing. If we're told it's impossible, that's when the best of us comes out and we feel like we have to respond. I would argue that our movement was born out of crisis. You know, the bats, I'm making air quotes, the bat signal hits the sky and all of us bat men and bat women, you know, we knew Gotham was in trouble. And so we just like all of a sudden we showed up and we started working. And when I look back, especially with this much hindsight, Mike, I think to myself, we were a group of regular people. You know, I knew you already. I knew Roy Barnes a little bit. I knew Chooch Pickard barely. And like a couple of just a gaggle of us Midtowners all of a sudden just were magnetized to each other. And in 5 months, in the first 6 months of our movement, we formed, made a nonprofit, stopped the demolition, put on Roundhouse Revival, and infiltrated the Urban Land Institute process and made sure that it went our way. I mean, I can't take all that credit because it was
What was the Urban Land Institute finding?
The Urban Land Institute, there were two major ways that they brushed back then HCD head Robert Lipscomb's plan. One was they said, the way you're planning to redevelop the fairgrounds with 400,000 square feet of retail is not sustainable. We suggest 15,000 to 20,000 square feet of, quote, smart retail. And they saved the headlining, you know, finding for the end, the closer, the set closer, Mike, which was they advocated to absolutely do not tear down the Coliseum. It was a sister building built at the same time as the Liberty Bowl. And it should be repurposed or reactivated in some way. So, and it's like from you and I, fall of 2014 to May of 2015, when Roundhouse Revival, and then June of 2015, when the Urban Land Institute made its, announced its findings at the Peabody. I'm just saying that's a lot for a group of people to come through, figure out, address, answer, and land a movement in the public consciousness by, you know, 4,500 people showing up to Roundhouse Revival. This day of music, wrestling, and basketball that, mm-hmm. quite frankly, you and others and I, you know, helped envision. And then to have a panel of ex-mayors descend on our city and us infiltrate that process and win the day, you know, when it was a very David versus Goliath situation, in my view.
Has any mayor had their own vision that wasn't whispered in their ear by an aide or an assistant, where somebody goes into the position knowing what they need to save, knowing mm-hmm. the cultural impact and importance of preservation, knowing how mm-hmm. closing down the fairgrounds would have put 500 kids in Orange Mound out of work in 2004 mm-hmm. or 5. Mm-hmm. It seems like these things are done in the interest of real estate. Who's making money out of these things? Mm-hmm. These are just, I guess, rhetorical statements of the cynicism we all feel towards government from time to time. And here we are sitting here tonight on election night. Is it easy to sweep everything that we did 10 years ago under the rug? Is it still relevant what the Urban Land mm-hmm. Institute found, what we all know to be common sense about the arena, about the Coliseum, and about other situations?
Oh, sure.
Is it still relevant? Is it still something that 100%. Can be brought up? Yes?
Yeah, no, okay. No. I mean, I think every ounce of work that we did is still serving the issue. There are,
because you went on beyond that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the Coliseum Coalition is active today. It's not very active. The organization that has really kind of taken the baton from us, although, you know, we're kind of running in place waiting for our next opportunity to serve the overarching mission, which is to reopen the Coliseum, is the Coliseum Conservancy. I won't be coy here. It's a group that we helped give rise to, you know, like we helped think through what that group would do differently.
Can you say who's in that currently?
Sure. It's been yeah. in the paper, you know, so like Corey Strong, former Shelby County Democratic head, Corey Strong, is leading the effort. Paula Casey's on that board, the woman who did the women's suffrage statues behind the law school, yeah. is on that board. J.W. Gibson is on that board. Ken May, former CEO of Top Golf, is on that board. I'm drawing a blank.
How do they connect with this? Yeah. What's their interest in
the call center? this relates to another thing I want to back up and say about, like, your question about, has there ever been a mayor who, like, stepped to the plate and knew all these things?
Well,
and,
I'm being a little flippant or cynical.
It's a good question, and it lays bare one thing that I had as I think we all step into work or activism of any sort. I know I did when we stepped into the arena with the Coliseum, is to say, we think that there's this, like, if you can only get the mayor's ear and reason through with whoever the mayor is. And I've learned that, like, at least Memphis, like, doesn't work that way, right? The mayor's not the boss of the city, right? A lot of people think, oh, the mayor can make happen what the mayor wants.
It's like the president of the United States. You can only do so much.
Well, that's true. But I just think, like, to put that much power or that much responsibility on a mayor is just... might there be a city out there that does have a mayor that, like you described, that's more of a leader, that's more proactive? Perhaps that exists right now.
Well,
at least
someone who's eloquently presenting the case for something, whether they get it or not.
The mayor's not going to drive the Coliseum issue. Never will. Now, if at the end we win the day, let's say we're waving a magic wand here, the Coliseum is set to reopen. We've somehow done it. We've, with the mix of fixed uses and event types, we've calibrated it. We've taken the kind of understanding of Crosstown Concourse, and we understand that it needs to be a diversified portfolio of use types to diversify the revenue streams, and we figured it out, right? And it's set to reopen. Is there going to be a mayor? And it'll likely be Paul, right? Will Paul then find the eloquent words to say, like, it is a proud day, these Memphians have labored hard, and, you know, like, I think he'll probably shine a light on the grassroots to give us a clap on the back. Were it not for them, we probably wouldn't be standing here on this proud day. But he's still going to be the mayor, and a lot of people reading the news are going to simply conclude, oh, look what Mayor Young did. Or whoever, and that's like whoever's president, or, you know, benefits from the good stuff that happens and gets blamed for the bad. My only point is, the mayor's not going to drive the Coliseum. So in answer to your question about, like, what's this new group and what do they do that we don't do, the one thing that we, the Coliseum Coalition was great at making the case and giving people the permission and an opportunity to say, you're not crazy. We love the Coliseum too. I don't know whether you remember this, but in the earliest days when we were saying, oh, the Coliseum's great, we got to bring back the Coliseum, that's when we had people do these double takes. They kind of look both ways and they go, you know, I've always loved the Coliseum too. Is that okay to say that? Can I say that? I know that might be, you know.
I remember going on a radio show with my son at the time, and I forget what station it was, but the guy was all set to sort of be that radio host kind of guy, snarky and you know, poking fun at the argument. And very quickly, it settled into a very serious tone about culture and history and the effects that positive things can have on crime. You know, cultural effects can have on crime and the identity of a city and why people would want to come here or move here. And I think we were good at that, was making the conversation very serious, and it wasn't about Motley Crue coming in.
It wasn't about nostalgia. It was about the utility of the building. And as we built our proof points, as we got Juch and his merry band of architects into the Coliseum to prove that the Coliseum was in excellent shape, and then when that was corroborated by the city's own finding that the building's in excellent shape, you know, the firm of Allen and Hochul corroborated that in 2017. So my point is, we knew it in our hearts at the outset. Then we did our homework and we proved that we were right, that the building's in excellent shape. And then the kind of groundswell of love for the Coliseum from the public, that's what changed. The Coliseum Coalition, if we did anything, we moved the needle on public opinion and swayed it where everybody was wanting to go anyway, which is love for the Coliseum. But the one thing that we never did, I realized in hindsight, that we didn't know we needed to do, is we never had the authority to redevelop the Coliseum at the city's behest. So when we would bring Mayor Strickland a perfectly good idea, like this group, the International Coliseums, coming out of the woodworks from Arizona, so they called me up one day and they said, we can't get anybody in your city to give us a call back. But we saw by the media accounts that this Coliseum Coalition guys are giving VIP tours. If we fly into Memphis on our own dime, would you give us one of those tours? And we said, sure. They come to town. Now, while we do our homework on them, and we realize they redevelop Coliseum-era venues all over the country. This is literally what they do. Mm-hmm. So they go, they come, they look at it, they go, Eureka, this place has better bones than most of the arenas that we brought back from the dead. Oh, this is so great. And of course, they got a meeting with the city. So we leave all enthusiastic, like, oh, this is really going to go somewhere. We brought a developer from out of town. Oh, this is really going to go places. Oh, you got a meeting? And they actually said, this is great. Look, we've got a meeting with your city tomorrow morning. Why don't we meet up here in the parking lot of the Coliseum and talk through next steps? And we left. And I remember thinking, we have finally broken through, right?
What year was this?
2018 or 19. And
okay,
and,
so you set everything up. The tour went great.
Here's what happened.
The city has given you permission to do these tours to begin with.
The city gave us permission to give. So I'm thinking it's going good places.
Yeah.
They met with the city, and the city told them, we can't have a conversation with you about the Coliseum because it's in the next phase of development. Now, that strikes me as just idiotic on its face. But it showed that Jim Strickland was never interested in redeveloping the Coliseum. So we could bring him all make and manner of good ideas, and Mayor Strickland would always just crumple them up and put them in the trash can because we didn't have the authority, right? We're just an advisory group of citizens trying to bring a good idea to City Hall, you know? But if you don't have a mayor that's willing to cooperate with the will of the people or doesn't think that they have enough time left in the shot clock of their administration to get it done so they can take credit in time, then it's not of any value for it. And that's the calculation that Mayor Strickland had made. And, you know, now that he's out of office and I don't have to deal with him, I can be a little bit more blunt. Yeah, Mayor Strickland didn't ever think that the Coliseum was going to come back, and he couldn't get it done within his administration. The reason I'm bullish and hopeful on Paul is because, first of all, I consider him a friend, and I think he's more open-minded. He's certainly more creative than plod, Jim Strickland. God bless him. You know, but
I just think, yeah, Lawler shouldn't have like signed up for Wharton that day in the ring at Roundhouse Revival with Strickland standing there, and Lawler said, "We're voting for Wharton."
That was a
and
unique
I remember Strickland
moment.
Just had a great laugh when that Lawler
was
said
that. That was a rich moment.
Let's keep politics out of maybe wrestling.
And remember how we got that somebody told us, yeah, they're going to make a commercial where Wharton's going to like pull back, and Wharton's going to be standing in the ring and. And bring the Coliseum back. All ancient history. We can chuckle about it now. But my point is, Paul has longer ahead of him. He's younger.
Yeah.
He's more creative. I mean, Paul loves the Coliseum. Paul graduated from the Coliseum. So I think that Paul is going to be more open to it. But again, the mayor is not going to drive the thing. So herein lies
But the mayor should not obstruct the normal drive.
Well, you'd rather them not. Yeah. But like,
that's,
but
I guess
it
that's
is what it is. Yeah. And Strickland couldn't see it, and that's okay. He's, you know. So at any rate, the difference in the Coliseum Conservancy is they've got a board with some, let's be honest, some true rainmakers on it, right? You got some people that are clouded people. And I'd like to sit here and say, Mike, it shouldn't matter that wealthy people are on your board or people who are connected are on your board. But it does matter. It does matter. The other thing is we have to solve this idea of having the authority. So now this is the point where I'm going to start to edge into talking in euphemisms because I don't want to like betray the hand of things that are going on. But I think that the Coliseum Conservancy needs to find a way to get official. They need to find the official recognition from governing bodies that they have the right to redevelop the Coliseum at the city's behest. I think once they have that, then they're, to use a wrestling analogy, we at the coalition as their tag team partners, it's going to be the time to tag us in and, you know, like come off the top rope.
Well, what's the Coliseum Coalition's role as the Conservancy now steps into place?
I think our role is to be, what the coalition is great at is passionately making the case for the Coliseum and having that groundswell of public support and bringing the public mindset to the table. So, I really think that I can foresee another Coliseum cleanup where we would do it both orgs together, rolling up our sleeves. The true work of that, but also the symbolism of that. We're not afraid to get our fingernail, some dirt under our fingernails to save the Coliseum.
Will the committee nature of the Conservancy make it move slower than the Coalition ever did?
That's a good question. I mean, we were saying before we started rolling that like our first year as the Coliseum Coalition was a real kind of like air quotes active war theater where it was like a real battle.
It was just a punk rock mentality toward reaching out to the media, being there first with the story.
And continuing to run circles around the opposition, which we did.
Yep.
And, you know, your leadership style suited the early Coliseum Coalition so well, Mike, because you were always focused on, did we take the hill? It was very, I mean, there's another war analogy, but what I'm saying here is that, like, in the last 8.5 years, it's been much more of a Cold War pace, which is gallingly, you know, like, ugh, it's like watching grass grow, right?
No, I got to say, Roy Barnes, current president, he's done a great job at exactly what you're talking about.
He has,
where emotionally or I would just maybe have more of a, I'd just be more, I don't know, I'd want something to happen faster.
Attack, attack, attack.
But not, that can't always happen.
That can't always happen. That's not always the best play. And I look at that and you know, on the human side, it's all sorts of people doing this, that, or the other. But like the right people came to the fore at the right time. And I think the right leadership style is coming to the fore. I think the leadership difference in the Coliseum Coalition and the Conservancy are complementing one another.
As I've done
interviews across other causes through my own Champions of the Lost Causes podcast, it's amazing how a cause will summon the right leaders at the right time. And not to get too mystical, I just think that like causes bring out the best in us, and they bring out the best in a community. And if there's a right person at the right time, take Angela Barksdale, perfect example, right? Like Angela Barksdale, one of Orange Mound's great matrons and activists, she wasn't part of the original Coliseum Coalition board, but we got to know Angela through our activism. Obviously, Orange Mound cares what happens to the Coliseum, so we got to know an Angela, and then she joined our board. One of the critical things that, and so they say, you need to diversify your board and make space at your table of leadership for all different types of people from all different backgrounds, races, genders, etc. Well, Angela's the perfect case. Like Angela ended up being on our board, and you know, it was natural for her to say in the early days, having so much having come before, she's like, I like to operate behind the scenes. But I remember at a certain point, we wanted to get those Coliseum murals up that are still up. They've been up for 3.5, almost 4 years now. Mm. And, you know, Angela, not to go into all the blocking and tackling of it, but like Angela's the one who had the relationship with Mayor Strickland. Angela said, this information you put together on your website, put it together for me in a book, and I'm going to go have a sit down with Jim. And she sat down with Jim Strickland, and she has a history of working on murals all over town, working on murals in Orange Mound. And she just sat down with Mayor Strickland and said, gave him a copy of the book, walked him through it. And he goes, and she just said, Mayor Strickland, this is what we're planning to do. I hope we can count on your support. And Mayor Strickland just told her, Angela, this is wonderful. And it was done. It was solved. Like, had we been as white men kind of petitioning Mayor Strickland through the normal channels, he probably would have squelched it out of like, you know, muscle, you know, reflexively. Mm-hmm. He'd be like, McCarthy and Stockwell and those guys, what if they wanted it, probably can't be good. But, you know, my friend Angela, who is, you know, mm-hmm. one of these important figures in Orange Mound, she was able to just get Mayor Strickland to say it was okay. And like, all of a sudden, every city agency just said, oh, yeah, we got the memo. Sure, when do you guys want to put them up? And people were like, how did y'all just like get that to go down like that? And it's because Angela asserted her own leadership. But my point is, she joined midstream. So the project calls the right people at the right time.
And what were you, what was your interest in creating the Friends of the Fairground? Because that's another talk about.
Yeah,
it came in between sort of the conservancy period that we have now and the beginning of the coalition.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. It's almost a lost chapter. But it actually still
has relevance. Well, it's a pre-COVID. Relevance. It's a pre-COVID chapter.
Yeah, it has relevancy. So my friend John Minervini and I, John and I got to be friends. John was like, oh, what's this you're working on? Oh, Coliseum. Oh, how interesting. And John was like, he helped me see that no matter what happens with the building, if a really great redevelopment of the Coliseum is envisioned without thinking about the wider land parcel, it's an incomplete equation, right? So I said, gosh, John, you're right. Although that's the scope of trying to figure out that. That's a lot to take
on. Wait, can you break that point down briefly?
Yeah, so it's the Coliseum Coalition is focused on one building. John's point was, this building exists inside a 155-acre land parcel. What about the rest of the land parcel? What are the other use types? I mean, getting to know Frank Smith, for the former partner at Wiseacre Beer, one of his early questions to me is like, I don't want to be on an island. When Wiseacre was looking at the Coliseum, what's the rest of the development going to be? And I said, Frank, that's what Friends of the Fairgrounds is convening, careful conversations to say to these neighbors and these stakeholders, what do you want it to be? So my point is, we first thought that Friends of the Fairgrounds could be a subcommittee of the Coliseum Coalition, but we realized it really deserved its own effort. So I stepped off the board, and then John and I created Friends of the Fairgrounds, and we led an intentional year and a half long stakeholder input process, whereby we ask people, what do you want to see the fairgrounds become? Now, obviously, people had some strong opinions about the Coliseum within that. Members of the Coliseum Coalition board and wider kind of planning committee participated in our stuff. And then in about a year and a half, we issued an executive summary, which basically just said, these neighborhood stakeholders want a safe, fair place for everyone. They want to feel welcomed in. They want design that's contiguous with their neighborhoods. They don't want to be left out. They want to be invited to the table. They want some place with family-friendly entertainment, and they want that Coliseum reopened. So it was a ratification and a corroboration of what we knew in our hearts, but through a different lens, with a wider kind of setting.
And yet, here we are.
We made a bold move to co-plan the fairgrounds with the city. Now,
do you think the soccer culture there has checked all those boxes off?
No. I feel like in hindsight, when I look back on our assertion that we could co-plan the fairgrounds with the city, I see that as a naive position. I still think that it was the right thing to claim, and the city should, in an ideal world, have taken us up on it.
Was the city welcoming to the Friends of the Fairground?
I'd say Paul Young was. Uh-huh. Paul Young, as head of HCD, was. Our last of what we thought were going to be a whole nother round of Friends at the Fairgrounds meetings, we co-hosted a meeting with Memphis 3.0. Current HCD head Ashley Cash was the head of Memphis 3.0, and we co-hosted a meeting at the Children's Museum. It went great, and we sat around a table at Otherlands with them and said, gosh, we have so much common cause. We can be an advisory board to Memphis 3.0 because we've been studying the fairgrounds. But no one's ever told me this, but I think that, Mayor Strickland said, don't get involved with these guys, have more meetings with them.
Why would he say that?
Because we were led to understand or told the fairgrounds is a carve out. It's not really going to be part of the Memphis 3.0 process. They never put that in a big pull quote in the press release that trumpeted Memphis 3.0, but the fairgrounds are not really part of Memphis 3.0. It was a carve out, and the reason it was a carve out is because Jim Strickland probably knew what he wanted to do, and he's a real stick to your guns kind of guy, and he was sold on that youth sports idea years ago, and he was like, by God, that was the thing he was gonna do no matter what.
It seemed like the safest thing to do to a certain constituency, but not to the people that had just put in the work for 10 years.
No, of course. It was the least imaginative thing to do.
Nothing wrong with what's there and what it can become and how the Coliseum could serve as a complement to it. I just wanted...
Okay, that's right.
So based on what you just said and all that... Now, how does that dovetail into the news last week about the TDZ providing zero taxes. Can you can you explain that a little
bit? Well, we all had a private chuckle there because we knew
the tourism development zone.
Yeah, the tourism development zone basically allows you to, for those who don't know, allows you to keep a portion of the sales tax that's based on a kind of gerrymandered map. So the idea here is if you say these are the areas we expect to grow because of the investment, then you can mark them and a baseline is set. And then any sales tax above the baseline, you get to retain locally. You don't have to send it to Nashville. And the money that you retain, that the TDZ retains, is used to pay down the bonds that you take out to do the thing. So it allows you to kind of like have the money to do the thing first. And you have to build the case that the use type you're proposing is going to be successful. And it's worth noting, and this is real work that I give the city credit for doing, Mary Claire Boris and Paul Young, that HCD team, they were, a lot of people said, that city will never get that TDZ plan passed in Nashville. That'll never happen. It passed unanimously. Now, I will say this.
With some caveats.
Exactly. The main caveat was we have it on good authority that people that state building commission that need to approve that leaned across the table and said, we'd be a lot more likely to vote for this if we knew that the Coliseum was going to be safe.
Right.
That's the reason. If you go back and look at the TDZ kind of like declaration of the city, they said what they ran into is they realized that the state building commissioners were confusing it with past plans. They're like, wait a minute, is Coliseum youth sports? I mean, didn't we vote this down or did this go away a couple of years ago? And they don't, no, but this plan's different than past plans. Well, youth sports, like, okay, tell me about it, right? Give me the bulleted list. So what they did, especially with respect to them saying we'd feel more comfortable if the Coliseum were preserved and not demolished, is that they went back and they said, this plan is different than past plans in the following ways. And one of those bullets was, the Coliseum is preserved and not demolished.
This was written down.
Yeah.
This was on paper.
It's a promise, but it's kind of like an historical designation. It doesn't ultimately safeguard a thing from destruction, right? But we took it as a huge victory. In the early days of the Strickland administration, we thought, well, that is as good a protection or as a promise to not demolish the Coliseum as we've ever achieved. And we took it as a victory. We took it as an indication that our lobbying had been successful and that we'd reached some people at the city. There was a really heady time in the early Strickland administration where lots of people within his administration were very bullish on the Coliseum being reopened. It's just ultimately, I think, what Mayor Strickland was hoping that somebody would do is some giant developer would kick his door in with a giant bag of money and say, we'll handle it, and you know, there's no heavy lifting for you at all, and it's done. All you have to do is show up for the photo op. And a building like Crosstown Concourse shows you that's never true. You know, like the city contributed 7% of Crosstown Concourse's overall project costs, and they only put it in after every other source of funding was secured and ironclad and in the bank. So this, again, back to the point, the city never leads. The city lets all other forces do their bit, and then at the last moment they go, okay, well, we're legally bound to do this last little piece. All right, we did it together, right? Mm-hmm. But so, like,
meanwhile, there's no tax base to hang around to enjoy it.
You know, hopefully they'll come back. But my point is, it's galling. You know, it's galling to have to do the work and then hold your tongue often. I mean, it takes restraint to stay at the table with forces that you're not sure are double dealing and are going to stab you in the back. And yeah, well, when the second demolition threat came along, it felt like a betrayal. But then we just bowed right back up. We ginned up the old war machine, and thankfully Mayor Strickland ran out of money. He had to spend it on the first two priorities stadium-wise, and he never got to priority number four, which was demolish the Coliseum to build a soccer stadium.
Explain that real quick, the running out of money motif.
So he gets this big pile of money from the state, the special state infusement.
With like less than a year in office.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so he had, and he said, oh yeah, we're going to do all these things for all these stadiums. And one of them is going to be a soccer stadium for, you know, and I know there's open land everywhere in Memphis, but it has to go right there on that plot where the Coliseum stands. well, wouldn't that cost add $10 million to the project cost? Get him out of here.
Get Marvin Stockwell out of here.
But my point is, and that's the reason, and this is a credit to Roy Barnes, Roy's the one that made that map that showed all the different places, even within the Liberty Park footprint, that the soccer stadium could go.
Oh, you mean the 155 acres?
The 155 giant acres. So, like, of course, it was him trying to kill two birds with one stone. He was like, it had been stuck in his craw, and he's like, on the way out, I'm going to take care of that pesky Coliseum and those damn Coliseum Coalition guys. I'll show them. You know, like, I'm the boss. I'm the decider. But he didn't get there, so back to the money thing. He got this special state infusement of cash, but the absolute gotta do is he has to take care of FedEx Forum, right? So, and FedEx Forum, as we've learned, I don't think they've officially tallied it, but it's most of that money, right? In second place for money, and that was the Simmons Liberty Bank Stadium, and even that took
the Liberty Bowl
yep. Took Fred Smith coming out from behind the curtain and putting $50 million more dollars on the table. And even still, the U of M still has to do their own fundraising. So those are your first two priorities: FedEx Forum and the Liberty Bowl. Priority number three was AutoZone Park. They didn't get any money either. That was priority number three. And in priority number four, in fourth place, was build a soccer stadium for our minor league soccer team by bulldozing the Coliseum, which on its face was not smart, and we quickly proved it. They never got there. Ran out of money, ran out of time, and we ran the clock out on him.
So is there more upkeep for an open-air arena like Redbirds Stadium or the Liberty Bowl? Is there more money that has to be spent because it's setting out there in the open? And with the Forum, I guess it has to maintain certain standards because of the professional basketball team, things that we wouldn't even really notice, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Thank God those, I've never thought I'd be happy that the money got sucked up in ways that most normal people would go, why are we spending money on that again? But there it went, and it had the weird alternative effect of saving the Coliseum by kicking the can down the road a little bit.
That's exactly right. In answer to your question, Mike, I don't know if there are special costs because they're outdoor venues. I will say that the big sticker price on FedEx Forum is because the plan is to significantly reorg the seats within FedEx Forum.
What do you mean?
So there's a trend in the NBA which says have more lower bowl seats. It allows you to maximize profits. And it's like if you can just slightly tweak things so that there's just like maybe, you know, I'm just making this up, like four more rows of lower bowl seats than there are upper deck. Then the upper deck, which a lot of nights when it's not very full, are empty seats anyway. Well, it allows you to charge and it allows you to earn more money. So the FedEx Forum is going, from what I understand, is a complete scraping of the inside and a complete rebuild of the seat allocation. That's the reason there's a
Does
really
Does that
good
increase
price
this number of seats?
That's a good question, Mike. I don't know that.
Because we were discussing, or everybody always brings up the non-compete clause, sure, where the simple solution with the Coliseum would be to reduce the seats below 5,000.
Right. Well, one thing I'll say about the Coliseum and the non-compete is that, like, I know that mentally people are like, it needs to be under 5,000 seats, but actually that pertains to new venues, and the Coliseum is an existing venue. So, like, to get under that 5,000 threshold, the only reason to fixate it on it is because so many people fixate on it, but it's actually completely false. Like, the Coliseum does not have to get under 5,000 seats. It is an existing venue. Now, I will say this. The market needs a mid-size venue. A lot has been made in the press recently of the fact that people are like, oh, well, Live Nation's been in the city. Yeah, they're looking at the amphitheater. And that's true. They are looking at the amphitheater. And it's kind of funny how, like, my current project, which we can talk about in a minute if you want to, Bevo at Mud Island, is all of a sudden, you know, it's got its own venue situation. But what fewer people know is that that Live Nation was also in town looking at the Coliseum. And if you kind of read between the lines of there was an op-ed, I'm going to forget who wrote it, but they in the thing it said, Live Nation identified that the hole in our market is a mid-sized venue.
Now, when was this?
Within the last year.
This was an article?
It was an op-ed.
Daily Memphian?
It was an op-ed, yeah. I think it was the former board chair of Memphis River Parks Partnership. But his point was, we don't know what's going to happen with the Mud Island Amphitheater. And that's true. We don't. I think his point
what
was...
What is the seating at Mud Island, by the way?
5,000.
Okay.
Ish.
But it's open.
But it's open. Mm-hmm. But so... It is open air. It is not open. It's actually closed in terms of, like, you can't host concerts there because of structural flaws, because of all sorts of things. But in that op-ed, I mean, we saw when Graceland decided to do what it did with its concert venues. They built something to host concerts of a certain size. The market needs a mid-sized venue. We are lacking in our portfolio of venue offerings. We are lacking a mid-sized venue, and more,
especially centrally located,
right?
And which Graceland isn't.
More, that's true. More acts on their way up and way down in popularity fit the mid-sized venue threshold. I mean, a few years. This has been several years ago now, but I saw the Foo Fighters and Motorhead at FedEx Forum. Great show. But it wasn't sold out. And we're talking about the Foo Fighters and Motorhead. So it's like very few concerts, not very few, but not enough to keep FedEx Forum, you know, kind of perpetually booked.
Who opened for who? Never mind.
Motorhead opened. Motorhead opened. And Dave Grohl himself was like, this seems somehow wrong.
Well, this gets me maybe to the last thing I'll ask you about this. There are seven or eight football games a season, right?
Mm-hmm.
How many events really are there at the Forum? It's certainly not something that's going on every night or three times. Not.
You know what? Former Pittsburgh Mayor Tom Murphy, who was the guy who led that ULI panel.
Yeah.
Remember he stopped by and like clapped us on the back as he had to leave for a flight. And,
yeah.
And never forget this. He said, keep fighting for that building, he told me, and he said, and let me know if there's any way I can help you. Now, I've kept in touch with Tom Murphy over the years, and in fact, this past summer I interviewed him in Pittsburgh. He's in his early 80s,
wow.
And I interviewed him in a park that he saved from, you know, how like in Memphis here we have I-240 almost went through Overton Park. Well, Pittsburgh had a similar situation, and he was a young 20 or 30-something activist. He started as an activist, and we did the interview in a park that was set to be demolished for an interstate going through there.
Mm.
But my point is, one of the things that I kept in touch with Tom Murphy about is he gave me a good lens of how does a mayor think about this. So whenever I would go to him and say, here's where we're at with Mayor Strickland, you know, how should I be thinking about this? One of the ideas he said, he goes, how many times is FedEx Forum used for something other than basketball in a calendar year? I said, oh gosh, that's a great question, Tom. I don't know. He goes, but you could figure it out, couldn't you? And I was like, you're right. So Marie Santucci, when it took this Coliseum Coalition board, Marie Santucci,
mm-hmm.
went and like geeked the website, whatever she needed to do to go figure this out. And what we found is, and I couldn't sit here and tell you the numbers, but it was a paltry number.
Yeah.
Very few non-basketball things happen at FedEx Forum. His point to me is they can claim that they're the mid-sized venue because they have curtains and they can curtain things off. And we can know qualitatively that that's total BS and that no one wants a concert experience like that. The mm-hmm. fans don't want it. The bands don't want it. But unless you know the industry, it just sounds like a perfectly reasonable defense. We don't need a mid-sized venue because we are the mid-sized venue. But Tom's the one that said, go figure out how many non-basketball things actually happen at FedEx Forum. And the answer is, not many.
Not many.
Not many. Why? Because no one wants to be there. It's too costly. It's downtown. No one wants to fight the parking.
Right.
And back to what our neighbors in Orange Mound have told us all along, that's not that that our home base is the Coliseum. We want the Coliseum back open because we can walk to it. It's more reasonably priced.
So what do you think about the idea of MATA and or a future train line, which wouldn't that help FedEx Forum as far as getting people down there and getting them out back out to Germantown and north, south? Wouldn't it be great if the idea of how we save the Coliseum and if not how we save the city comes internally from our own, you know, thinking and our own, you know,
ingenuity,
our own think tank?
Isn't that the Memphis way?
Yeah, but time and time again, we pay people with from outsiders from other places instead of paying outliers within the city who have radical ideas, who maybe went to the Antenna Club a few times, who maybe, you know, are coming from the cultural identity that Memphis has spewed out. Maybe those are the people that know the city very well because we've been in the dark corners.
Amen
of the
to
city.
That. Sam Phillips didn't have that take that approach.
Yeah, and you know, used to there were trains coming and going, and I know right. that there are a few people in town in positions of power that have thought about this and spoken to the idea of mass transit. And of course the MATA thing that's going on right now is a debate. Mm-hmm. I don't know enough about it to actually sit here and go, well, this could happen with this stuff and these allotted funds could be here and there.
Sure.
I don't know about that, but obviously we have the power to figure this out. And again, it goes back to my point about the mayor think or the council, city council, or the county commission.
It's like
let's
people.
Put the cause and effect thing in order, and surely there's federal money there. American cities are waking up to the idea of the pre-Eisenhower highway system has pretty much done its thing and is in constant need of repair. Why can't we have that train system? And at the very least, the Coliseum could be used as a hub for that.
I think it's a good idea. And here's where I think we've got the thing that will actually help reopen the Coliseum or take Crosstown Concourse.
Yeah.
The deliberative process of figuring out either of those projects takes time and intentionality. If you throw on top of it the political process of like, come up with a solution out of your by tonight's meeting.
Well,
you
know, you're
never going
to
get there.
I'm just saying that I want to vote for people that have vision and have the power to at least start the conversation, have the subcommittees, find the money, and they may be out of office by the time it happens, of course. But I don't want to pay people just to go sign checks and show up at meetings and cut ribbons, and no one's going to pay us to do these things. Mm-hmm. And we have some good ideas, not all good ideas,
sure.
But then we get distracted by life. These other people are in positions of power. We pay them not to be distracted.
I totally could, you know, Tom Murphy's a great example. He's the mayor that's largely credited with saving Pittsburgh and weaning them off their steel economy and into their current economy and their vibrance. Here's the key component. It takes courage and vision and willingness to maybe be wrong. Tom Murphy was roundly criticized for his approach to like, he basically said the city of Pittsburgh has to buy up these properties. And they're like, what are you even doing? My point is he took a radical step and it worked. Now, he could have taken those radical steps and it could have blown up in his face. But my point is he took action, right?
Yeah.
But I just think that like in our current, we'd love to, Hollywood stories are filled with people, you know, Jimmy Stewart filibustering, you know, until he's hoarse at 3 a.m. and somehow they win the day. And I'm just saying like that's movie narrative story arc, you know, that's made for short attention spans. But
well, it taps into the archetypes of whatever. But no, I'm talking in a very real way. I'm just saying that I would respect someone more who did take up for an idea and put up with the bullshit and the negative connotations.
Yeah.
And if they go down fighting, all the better. And it might behoove them to do that on
sure.
behalf of grassroots ideas, positive thinking.
Yeah.
You know, cynicism arises out of the fact that no one's hearing or doing anything about mm-hmm. a good idea. That's kind of where the French Revolution comes from.
Paul Young put some money in his budget for the Mud Island Amphitheater. You know, I could see, you know, a more milquetoast predecessor of his, you know, like just
sure,
muddling through
sure, sure.
and just like, quite frankly, you know,
well, so
licking
what
the boots of the oligarchs. You know, like Paul's at least to kind of like his own man. Yes, he has
yes.
to deal with these powerful figures that have this immense wealth. You want to play off what they're able to do because many of them want what's best for the city too. And why wouldn't you want to leverage that great wealth? So,
you also have to be beholden to the people that put you in as well. But why can't those people have also some? They can still have their real estate agenda, and we can have something two, and I've raised two kids here. You're raising like a whole. How many kids you have?
Three.
Five.
Okay. Three. Five. Three. No, but I mean,
we didn't have any amusement park. We didn't have any roller coaster. We didn't have. We don't even have a Ferris wheel. Martin.
You're leading me to a perfect segue, Mike. You know what that is.
And I wanted to segue it like this. Paul Young wants to put together an arts organization. Mm-hmm. Can you? I'm saying you know a lot about this, but it probably you do know a little bit. Can you talk a little bit about that and then dovetail into what you're doing at Mud Island?
Yeah. So, I mean, to your point, people have been clamoring for, if not Liberty Land itself, something that scratches the same itch as Liberty Land. People want to have fun, right? Mm-hmm. Gone are the water parks, gone are Liberty Land. We want to have fun. For our friends of the fairground stakeholders told us they wanted fun family entertainment. Now, I would argue that that is what Baron von Opperbein and the River of Time is. That's what Bevo is. And to Paul's credit, he was the first one to suggest that we consider, what would you think about building it at Mud Island? Not when he was mayor, but when he was head of the Downtown Memphis Commission. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yep, he suggested that to us. Now, Paul also campaigned on arts as an economic driver. Okay, but a lot of people campaign on something and then they get elected and they just go, they don't do anything about it. Paul has made a hire, and I'm going to forget the gentleman's name. But so Paul has followed through on that and hired that. I would argue that Bevo is a perfect case example of what that is. We are on Mud Island building this immersive experience. And sure, it's going to have to fit inside a wider development. Are there going to need to be developers that figure out the other pieces to this? Absolutely. But I would argue that we are the kind of beachhead on the island, if you will, that's redeveloping an asset. And it is a very similar public cheering that Mud Island is getting that the Coliseum got. The people want to see the Coliseum come back. People want to see Mud Island come back. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had we have raised about $140,000 of seed funding through a WeFunder crowd investing campaign. And some people we didn't even know have come out of the woodworks and put down $10,000 in investment. We're not a nonprofit, it's for profit. A $10,000 investment. One of those people, Michael Scarborough, he's on our board of advisors. He helped co-found the company Prospero in downtown Memphis. He was very successful. One of the things that, like, he likes our project on the merits, but one of the things that it was his initial thing was, oh man, this is a project that's going to help bring Mud Island back. So my point is, I think I am just wildly optimistic enough to say that we, as the group of kind of like crazy, air quotes, crazy artist folks that are in there doing Bevo, we are the creative leads on bringing Mud Island back, that I think that the developers are going to follow and add on and tag on into. And are there wealthy individuals that are in the wings that are gonna take part in both our effort and the wider effort? Absolutely. The project won't get done without it. But my point is, we have to give at least a little bit of leadership credit to Paul Young. Having a good idea is a great thing. I'm glad that he played that part in our origin story. But the fact that he campaigned on arts as an economic driver and then has made a decision as mayor to follow through on that, I think matters. I think it is going to be wind in our collective sails, not just Bevo, but other creative projects. He's essentially saying, I'm doing what I said I was going to do.
But that's an example of having vision.
It is. It is. So, like, you know, it's early in Paul's mayorship, and I don't want to give him too much credit, even though he's a friend of mine. But it makes me happy. It makes me glad because I think to myself, Paul Young seems to be his own man. Yes, he has to absolutely factor in the desires of these very wealthy and very well-connected people who often go unmentioned in news stories because that's the way they want it, right? Like, he has to deal with those people and take their... Who wouldn't want to those factors into concern? But my point is, he's also listening to those of us in the grassroots. I'm not a person of means, and he's listening to me. So my point is, I think this might be a case example. I'm just wildly optimistic enough to think that this could be an example of things changing.
So has Paul expressed an overall view of Mud Island redevelopment, or how that might even dovetail into what Carol Coletta was doing with the riverfront, or is there some larger picture here?
I have not talked to Paul about that. I think it is kind of obvious on its face that I shouldn't act like we're the only entity on Mud Island. I want to give a shout out to Mahogany Restaurant, which if you haven't been there, go there. Go to the one on East Memphis, but you really treat yourself. Go to the one on Mud Island because you can sit outside on the patio, and with this odd weather into November, it's still nice if you hurry. So we had a Bevo team building lunch on the deck at Mahogany, and we're sitting there eating this incredible food. And we're on the Mississippi River. It's like it's the old River Terrace restaurant space, if people will remember. So my point is, we have neighbors on Mud Island. I mean, Mahogany is actually open for business, and they're doing really well. We are a work in development. But my point is, there are at least two entities. And it's worth noting that Mud Island is already a city park, right? It's maintained.
Yeah.
There's more foot traffic on Mud Island than I would have thought.
We used to have so many birthday parties there when my kids were growing up.
Yeah.
Even though it seemed not very occupied, we could still go there and have birthday parties.
Sure. And this past weekend, we just had a rock and romp there. Had a great crowd.
Right.
So, like, we
about how many people were there?
Oh, I'd say, 225 maybe.
Yeah.
Who
played?
Hope Claiborne Soul Scrimmage.
Okay.
It was an incredible Memphis band. But we had a costume contest. We had food trucks and Mem Pops and Jimmy Ogle immediately following the
did
thing.
Did you have beer?
We did have a beer. we had beer there. So we had great food. We had arts and crafts. We had a martial arts demo. Because Reyes
does. Is that Christopher Reyes?
Yeah, he led his group of
kids.
You
want to talk about Chris real quick? Say who he is?
Sure, yes.
So what he is?
Christopher Reyes is our kind of creative lead. I'm glad he is. Let's just leave it at that.
Right.
Christopher Reyes did a Bevo pop-up in 2020, and they got 4,000 people through that in the pandemic safely in clustered units with cleaning protocols and all the right stuff. But they got 4,000 people through there at Yvonne Bobo's old space on Walnut Street,
off the Wall
Arts, yeah. The tickets sold out in 2 days. So not only was that cool in and of its own right, but it also was a proof of concept. It showed that Memphis is really ready for an immersive experience. Immersive experiences make lots of money. Now, there isn't one in Memphis, so a lot of people, immersive experiences, what is that, right? And from that point on, Chris started thinking, what's the next place I can go take Bevo? Now, the thing that actually brought us back together as friends, not that we, you know, ever fell out, but just the way we kind of reconvened around this, is that Chris had the idea that he wanted to put Baron Von Opperveen in the Coliseum. And so he turned to his buddy who knows a lot about the Coliseum, me. It was 2021. Chris was at kind of like, he'd done the Bevo pop-up, but he was kind of searching for like what's next. I'd been freshly laid off from St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in a pandemic-related layoff. I had next to nothing to do. And so during those days where people weren't really back out from the pandemic, Chris and I just got together at French Truck at Crosstown Concourse and started talking about the Coliseum, talking about Bevo, talking about where else it could be. Now, ultimately, the current space that we're building it in, which is the old Mississippi River Museum at Mud Island, 33,000 square feet. It's a purpose-built, immersive by design museum space that is it's an incredible canvas upon which to paint the Baron Von Opperveen story. As much as I love the Coliseum, I think the museum space is a perfect venue to build Bevo. Could there be an awesome Bevo at the Coliseum? Sure, it could absolutely work in the Coliseum surrounded by other amenities because there's a ton of square footage. But I'm just saying, like, to go from a 2,000 square foot pop-up to the enormity of the Coliseum is probably too far of a leap. I think the Mississippi River Museum is a perfect space. And so we're raising money we're looking to raise $10 million to build out Bevo at Mud Island. So far, we've only raised $140,000 of what we consider seed capital through a crowd investing campaign. But that's been enough to get started. And we've got the first two rooms. Well, the first room, we've got it really is starting to look like the Baron's world in there. The second room, quite frankly, we don't quite have the money to pay for the tech, the screens, the surround sound audio that we want to have, but we've got it at least partially built out.
Can you open in stages?
Yes, we do plan to open in stages. We plan to open phase one next summer, next spring or next summer. And that's really like, as soon as we get major investment, which we have not gotten just yet. And I can speak to why here in a second, but we haven't had it yet. And it's really, we need bigger investment because that'll allow us to hire up a squad of people that can make us go faster. Right now we're operating at the speed of Reyes, and Reyes is pretty great, but you know, Reyes is 55 like I am. And you know, he's not the Chris Reyes of the early aughts.
Well, I see Chris like in a NASA control center that overlooks every, like all the monitors have Bevo rooms on them, and he's just there. He's like the wizard, right? He's pulling all the levers.
Well, right now he's absolutely in that main room painting every last board and weathering itch thing and making it look like an old rusty spaceport.
I would give you some old rustic sort of like antique things, but right now I'm using them in my house for furniture. Hello, come on.
Well, hey, we're going to be building it for some time, so like as you have occasion, we'll take it.
So let's look ahead. So much of our conversations that we have are built on the past, and we find uses for the past, and we think, how can we make things better? Our kids are getting older. Our kids mm-hmm. missed out on opportunities or just fun stuff that we had growing up in Memphis. Well, I didn't grow up, but you know, I got here relatively young, and my immaturity was very slow, so it was like I was young. My maturity level. Take me through a scenario next summer. Bevo is open. You want it to be open, of course, full blown, however many chambers or immersive levels there are to this, and you should also probably, before we call it a night, you should probably talk about what the concept is overall for this particular thing, because people might compare it to Meow Wolf or some other immersive venues that are in America and like that. But let's say that there's a family in Germantown. Maybe they just moved here. Maybe they're in Collierville, Bartlett, wherever they are, Midtown. They want to get in a car with the kids, and they want to drive to Mud Island, I guess down Poplar. Where do they park? How do they get into the place? What do you think it's going to cost? What is the experience like? Yeah. What's your vision or Chris's vision for all that?
Sure. So I'll back up and say briefly what it is.
Yeah.
So an immersive experience, you mentioned Meow Wolf. Meow Wolf is the kind of like leading kind of like example within our industry, right?
Sure.
Our sector for what immersive experiences can earn. Just to put this in perspective, 15 years ago, and there's a documentary on Netflix. You can go watch the Meow Wolf origin story on Netflix. But Meow Wolf was a bunch of 20 and 30 somethings on the outside of the Santa Fe art scene who were looked at like as the crazy, like, you know, the punk rockers of Santa Fe, but on the art world. And they're like, what is this unorthodox thing you're preparing to do? We're going to have a gallery show. You go have your fun, right? They were not looked on as serious at all. 15 years later, they're sitting atop a $1 billion company that's in five cities and is set to expand into two more. They're making boatloads of money. So, and we're not doing this just to make money. We are encouraged that immersive experiences make money. The other corollary here is a lot of people might have been to the City Museum in St. Louis.
St. Louis.
We are wedding the artistry of Meow Wolf, although I would argue we're going to take it up several notches. With the climbability and playground aspect of the City Museum. And then we're going to bring something to the table that Meow Wolf didn't, and that's deeper, richer story narrative and character development. And we're also going to bring and infuse the experience with screens, not phone screens. You're not going to be stuck looking at your phone, but you're going to have screens in front of you that expand the universe and allow us to use digital means game engine technology to expand the experience beyond the kind of brick and mortar arts and crafts land that Chris is best at building. Our chief of games and technology, Catherine Hicks, is just a unicorn of a creative dynamo who has worked in the augmented reality, extended reality, AI holograms. We're going to have AI holograms in this that you can talk to. So a bit about the storyline, right? The Baron has gone missing in the multiverse. Why is he missing? He's looking for the love of his life, Louise. Now, to keep himself company, he made an AI version of Louise. Now, in the original Bebo pop-up, Louise was a... there were buttons that you could press, and pre-recorded lines of dialogue would give you these hints to understand the world you were in, right? But this is the year 2024, and holographic AI characters that you can actually talk to and who can talk back is a reality now. So we're going to have that in the River of Time on Mud Island. So you'll be able to go... It'll be like an open world video game. A lot of my kids love playing Legend of Zelda, Breath of the Wild, or Tears of the Kingdom. Those open world video games are the games where you can kind of walk anywhere, and there are all sorts of subquests, and you build out the map as you go. Baron von Oppermin and the River of Time will be like an open world video game, but you're walking around a physical space.
I think a lot of people have heard about this now. A couple thousand people maybe have read about it, or they local. I mean, people that maybe aren't going to give you any money until the day they show up to buy a ticket. But for you to explain that premise like you just did, I'm sure people are like, ah, that's...
I get the nugget.
That's what it is. You're not going to go to a movie unless you hear a review.
So now, in terms of people experiencing it, I mean, yes, we want people all over the Memphis MSA to enjoy it. But I think it's worth noting that this will be the first immersive experience on this scale in the South. Right. And when you consider Memphis's centrality drive time wise, we're going to be a tourist draw. This is going to be about what Memphians want to do, but this is also going to be about what people in Little Rock want to do and Meridian, Mississippi, and what they want to come up and spend a weekend doing. Even during Chris's pop-up in 2020, he had people coming from other cities to experience it. That shows the power of immersive experiences. I think that'll all the more be the case. I mean, we have in our kind of pitch deck, you know, any project you do, you got to have a pitch deck. And one of the things that shows the map of the United States and the drive radius and just how many people are with... Oh, take the City Museum, a case example. How many times have I taken my kids up to St. Louis to go to the City Museum? Got to be close to a dozen times at this point. Well, that's a 5-hour drive to St. Louis that I'm willing to make as a dad because it's fun, right? Yeah. We want to replicate that. We want St. Louis people coming down to Memphis.
Just like we had to drive to Arkansas to find a roller coaster.
That's right. That's right. So I think we're going to add to the tourist draw. And then I think, you know, your other question is like, you know, explain what this is going to feel like. I think by the time we open, news will have broken about the wider plan for Mud Island. I have some idea as to what that might look like and who the players might be. I'm not at a place where I can share that, and it might not even happen, right? Or the players may change. But there is a plan. There are people who are starting to go, you know, Mud Island's too awesome to have it, you know, continue to not be its best. So I personally am bullish on us being successful. Even if we were the only thing on the island, if it were us and Mahogany for the next couple of years, I like our chances.
If you put us
in some surroundings where we're surrounded by other amenities that make sense, sure, that would allow a family to plan their day and say, we can go to Bevo and then we can go to this place for a quick drink and then we can go shopping here and then we can do and I'm making some of this up, mini golf course. Like, I don't know that there's going to be a mini golf course,
sure,
but you know what I'm saying? But like, and then we can maybe go to a concert at the amphitheater. Like, if they can
this is the same scenario that we've talked about for the fairgrounds and the Coliseum.
Well, that's exactly right. It has to do with an intentional, well thought through plan for the land parcel. And the Coliseum is still stuck inside of a development that itself is sputtering back to the TDZ earning $0.
Sure.
It's not earning the revenue that that Mayor Strickland said it would.
There's nothing there to earn it the revenue.
Well, the youth sports building is there.
How could it be that youth sports building, the soccer, mostly soccer venue, right? I've never been inside.
It's not
a
soccer venue.
What is it?
It's an indoor sports venue. See, this goes to show you the power of the Lipscomb idea still hanging around.
Well, there's no PR that proves it isn't a soccer venue.
Well, yeah. So, but no, it's indoor sports related, you know, basketball and volleyball.
So my larger question or point is, how could it not have generated some income already?
No, it has. It hasn't earned above the baseline,
the cost,
the amount that the TDZ is able to hold back in sales tax revenue is what you earn north of the baseline that's set. So I mean, it is a true point, although I think this is overstated, but the pandemic had an effect on that. Like, the overall economic vitality is lower than the baseline, and the you have to get above the baseline to earn funds above and beyond that you can hold locally.
So how many opportunities do you have to spend money right now if you go into the sports complex?
Well, okay, keep in mind that it is the increase in revenue for revenue or tax receipts at in Cooper Young in Overton
Square. Oh, it's all
that.
True.
It's that whole neighborhood. Like it's worth noting that the previous year, I think the TDZ brought in $670,000. Don't quote me on that, but it was in the Daily Memphian article. It brought in several hundred thousand dollars, $670,000 worth of TDZ revenue. It's this in this past year, it really, really underperformed such that actually it didn't bring in any sales tax dollar. It didn't bring any sales tax dollars north of the baseline.
Could that have something to do with inflated food cost in restaurant areas like Cooper Young?
It could. I mean, you know, like with inflation, people have less discretionary income. That's probably a downward pressure on people going out to eat.
And I got
to
get Harry in here from 901 Toys and Comics and the whole Collector's Row.
Yeah,
you do. Because they keep strengthening that end of the neighborhood there and opening, reopening
Love
things
to see
and
it.
All that.
Love
so
to see it. Yep.
Despite these cautionary tales of inflation and all these things that are defeating a lot of profit margins, they continue. I got to have him in to talk about that stuff and including his music as well.
Yeah. I'm encouraged by all the things that are going on in that realm. I mean, I don't know whether that's a matter of like people are doing or not doing more expensive things, but they're still kind of maintaining their comic and action figure budget. I don't know how all that works.
Art as a driver, capitalistic driver for mm-hmm. Memphis, you're bullish on it. You obviously are so involved in it. You want to make it happen. Mm-hmm. Are there other things going on in the city that you are optimistic about? Are you so involved in Bevo right now that seems like you're the kind of guy that has mm-hmm. you know about what's going on in town? Are there other things that have got you excited or even could work in tandem with Bevo?
That's a good question. We've gotten to really know some of the people at the Downtown Memphis Commission really well, and I've mm-hmm. gotten on some of those hard hat tours. Mm-hmm. And the kind of enlightening thing there is like you get to go, you know, literally put on a hard hat and go take a tour of these developments in the works. Some of it's new construction, some of it's repurposed stuff, and I've only been on a few of them, but I'm encouraged when I see that development in, say, the Snuff District. You know, they had Lauren Ray Holterman had her Monster Market at that place, the Medicine Factory. You know, so they're all make and manner of these neat spaces that we didn't know were there that are coming back online as activations, ultimately towards some permanent use, you hope. I would say that I am, you know, I am really, really in the weeds with Bevo because it's my project. So I might not be as tapped into everything that's happening. I mean, you mentioned one of the sources of encouragement, which is Harry and you know, like mm-hmm. Java Cabana being purchased and now it's renovated. Right. That's a square footage wise, that's a fairly small thing, but I think it's important. Or take the Young Avenue Sound being redeveloped and Elliot Ives and Taylor Berger and that investment group are really taking Young Avenue Sound back to the lab.
Okay.
And now there's this outdoor performance venue that's part of that whole deal. And I'm going to forget the name of it. But I was just talking to Hope Claiborne and she's like, oh, yeah, we had this awesome gig. And when she ended up, oh, it's that thing that Taylor Berger and Elliot Ives is doing over in Cooper Young.
Okay.
Well, so lots of stuff afoot.
Do you see Bevo being a place where pop-ups happen?
Bevo wants to, from its founding, be a place where creative Memphis shows up and shows out. This isn't about us four co-founders and our ingenuity. It's that too. But our point is we always want a open seat at the table for other people to come and add their creativity. we want to, you know, Chris wrote the soundtrack, this ambient music for the pop-up Bevo. He's written a couple pieces of ambient music for the current Bevo. But we ultimately want to collaborate with Memphis bands. We've got a conversation, at least an exploratory conversation, with the Memphis Symphony. What would it look like to have a breakout of symphonic musicians collaborating with an ambient piece of music to create something for the Bevo soundtrack? We want the art of Bevo to reflect the wider community, both in its forming and founding and the build out, but ongoing. Once Bevo's totally built out, what we want to do is essentially recapture that Live from Memphis ethos, Chris Reyes's mm-hmm. old company that he operated 2001 to about 2012 mm-hmm. And 2013-14 in other forms, but like that great community blend of inviting the entire creative community to collaborate with one another. That ethos we're going to see come back to life and serve Bevo well in an ongoing way. One concrete example is there's a gallery that's part of the River Room. You know, the old River Room, we're relaunching. We started calling it our lounge, and it's our lounge. It's our party space. But we started referring to it as the River Room because we think actually the original title of that room fits the River of Time perfectly. It's the River Room, right? Yeah. So in relaunching the River Room, and I will say, we have our first holiday party booking for our River Room. So if there's anybody out there looking for the really great one-of-a-kind party venue in the, and my friend and yours, Leah Fox Greenberg, was reminding me that it's also bar mitzvah and bat mitzvah season as well. Mm. So if you're out there looking for a great party space to have your place, where Bevo's River Room is about to be open for business. It's a cool party space, but one of the pieces of it upstairs is what is going to be a rotating gallery. So we want to have gallery shows up there. Mm-hmm. It's not a huge space. You couldn't have a huge art show. But you could have a rotating set of artists. It could be an artist a month. It could be the winners of a high school art contest. I don't know what, you know, there are lots of different things you could do with it, but we want the community to be at the table ongoing. We ultimately want to build out a field trip structure, and we want to be integrated with students and schools. Mm-hmm. We want art students to be able to come, especially during the build out, and see active working artists working to transform a civic space into something that's full of imagination and whimsy and wonder. And we want them to be inspired by that. So, and then even once Bevo's built out, we want ongoing, you know, STEM and STEAM related education components. Live from Memphis had interns. We want to have an ongoing system of young people infusing the project with their creativity and adding their own creativity to the, and then learning and growing and becoming inspired as a stepstone to their own career. And I say that, you know, with good reason, because my own daughter, Viv, is home for this fall semester interning on Bevo. She is a junior at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, so she's taking online classes, and she's interning at Bevo. So my own daughter's working with me on the project. Oh, that's cool. That's pretty satisfying on the dad side, I got to be honest.
All right. Well, listen, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
We didn't talk about certain other things, like you playing in a band called Pez for how many decades?
Coming up on 35 years. I mean, I'm happy to come back at some later time and talk Pez. We're not as active as we once were, but we just recently played the High Tones 25th anniversary. That was a lot of fun.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mike.
You're appreciate a great you. Friend.
And you're a good friend.
I love thank talking you so to you. And something yeah. about right now, talking about all these things and having our friendship really gel around the Coliseum. Yeah. And, you know, this week is the 60th anniversary of the Coliseum opening. Yeah. It's a good time for you to be here, and I appreciate you coming in.
I appreciate it so much you having me, Mike. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.